This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 6th of January 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Today, we're going to be visiting the subtropical Portuguese island of Madeira to meet one very inspired interior designer.
People believe I do things with soul, because when you go to a place, it's not really what you see, it's what you feel. And that's what people call minimalism. It's a minimalism with soul.
We'll be hearing from Portland, Oregon, where a postmodernist architectural masterpiece, loved by some, hated by many, is spared the wrecking ball for now.
It is the first significant work of postmodernism built in the United States, but it has always been bedeviled by controversy and quite a few technical problems.
And we speak to a Swiss architect whose new house is a radical reinterpretation of a very traditional building type.
This Stöckli is in a very wonderful landscape, but there is not much more than the landscape. So principally, the landscape is the topic of the Stöckli.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. And to kick off, it's a new year, so where better to start than in New York? It's the city that never sleeps, and the last couple of months have been action-packed in the world of architecture there, with the opening of One World Trade Center, plus the unveiling of the new extended Cooper Hewitt Museum. There's much to catch up on in the Big Apple and beyond. And to bring us up to date, I'm pleased to say I am joined now on the line from our New York bureau by Alan Brake, the executive editor of the Architects newspaper. So let's start with the slightly sort of strange opening of One World Trade Center.
Well, New York has gotten its sort of exclamation point back, you could say. The tip of Lower Manhattan has a very tall, very large building again, and it's finally reopened after a long and somewhat tortured process.
I mean, it was a strange to bring this building into reality. It was a very complicated, and obviously because of the nature of the building and what happened before it. What's actually there now? Tell us what it looks like.
Well, it's, as I said, a very large building, to say the least. It's actually now, according to the figures, the largest building in the Western Hemisphere. So it is a very tall, very glassy, slightly tapered tower. The edges are sort of trimmed off, you know, in this sort of effort to make it look a little bit more maybe like an obelisk. As I said, a building of this size, you know, it's hard to kind of make it elegant. So, as I said, it's sort of, in a way, sort of restores the balance of Manhattan so that the downtown skyline and the midtown skyline have a sort of similar weight. But again, that's because the building itself is very large and quite brutish.
What's the general feeling like about the building in New York?
In a sense, it's nice to, again, have the skyline kind of re-emphasized. At the same time, I don't think many people think the building itself is a tremendous success architecturally. There were a lot of compromises that were made throughout the process of getting it built. You know, the sort of owner changed hands a couple of times. You know, the base of the building was sort of stripped back and simplified. The antenna, which was meant to be a kind of soaring spire on top of the building, is really just an antenna. It was also quite reduced in its sort of ambition, though not its size. So it's a mixed bag.
I read one review that said it's a project fraught with the agony of meaning. Do you think it's sort of because of the very sensitive nature of the building and its site that so many people just were sort of cowardly about what to do with it? Or do you think it's actually good to see quite a big functional building there?
Well, I mean, it's complicated in that the building is essentially a conventional office building. There will be an observation deck and a restaurant and things like that, but overall it's basically just a very big office building. At the same time, obviously because of what happened on the site, it was always meant to somehow capture something great about the spirit of New York and the sort of resilience of America. I'm not sure that it's risen to that level. I mean, even the name, for a long time, it was referred to as the Freedom Tower. And then, you know, that was sort of stripped away as well, and now it's simply referred to as One World Trade.
It's a bit of a missed opportunity, do you think?
Yeah, there are other good things going on at that site. You know, the memorial and the museum are quite impressive and moving and meaningful. I don't think One World Trade will be considered the sort of highlight of that overall site.
Let's cross town now to the Cooper Hewitt, which has recently reopened.
That's actually a very happy story. The Cooper Hewitt has been closed for over 3 years for a very sensitive but quite complicated renovation. It's the nation's design museum, so it's been very much missed in those 3 years, though they've done a lot of programming and things off-site. It's very nice to kind of have it back in the cultural landscape of the city.
But it still kept its charm, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a really long list of designers who are involved in the project. The kind of lead architect is a well-respected New York firm called Gluckman Maynor Architects, and they're very well-known for galleries as well as historical renovations. And they made a lot of really smart calls kind of throughout the process, you know, what to keep, what to sort of strip back. The third floor has a kind of central small gallery that has all this elaborate original wood paneling from the mansion, but then all the surrounding galleries around it are all stripped down kind of white box galleries. So it's both more flexible for the museum, but also retains some of its history.
Yeah, and the character is still there. On that subject, we should talk about a recent controversy over the Frick Collection, which is another sort of historical icon museum in the city, but they have quite controversial plans, don't they?
Yeah, no, and I think there's a real connection there. Both museums occupy mansions by sort of tycoons of the robber baron era, and the Frick is pushing ahead with a very large expansion, which will eliminate one of its gardens, a very beautiful viewing garden. They're planning to build quite a large, I believe it's six-story addition behind the low-lying mansion, and include a lot of new spaces in that addition and eliminate this garden along the way. So a lot of people are looking at the Cooper Hewitt expansion as a more sensitive model than the kind of quite large plan that the Frick is pushing for.
What's your take on that? I mean, I think, you know, with sort of museum renovations, it's all too easy to sort of get a bit precious about keeping things the way they are and keeping these sort of nice old museums cozy and cute and small. But actually, you know, the Frick Collection has got a great, great collection. It sort of needs to expand at the cost of a nice garden when Central Park's around the corner, don't you think?
That's their argument for sure. It's a tricky call. I mean, the Frick, as you say, is a very distinctive museum. And when you begin to tinker with that at the sort of level that they're considering, you know, it raises a lot of alarms for people. I'm not opposed to them trying to meet their own needs and grow in a responsible way. I guess the question is just, is this the best way to do it?
And from the sublime to the ridiculous, perhaps, let's move to LA and talk about the Broad Museum, which sort of a long-awaited construction, whose scaffold recently came down.
Yeah, so this project, you know, Eli and Edith Broad are very serious sort of power brokers in the LA cultural scene. This museum is for their personal collection. And as you say, it's much anticipated. It's been many years in the making. It's sort of a breakout project for Diller Scofidio Renfro, a freestanding building, a standalone museum. It was meant to have this very interesting sort of honeycomb facade exterior that almost made the building sort of look like a slightly more rectilinear piece of coral. You know, it had this sort of very porous, very three-dimensional facade structure. That has proved to be very difficult to make. The scaffolding has just come down, and we now actually get to see what the reality of the museum looks like.
And your thoughts on that?
Well, let's, you know, we've all gotten to the point where we've come to expect everything to look exactly like the rendering that's put out, you know, when a project is announced. You know, we've gotten very sophisticated in what we can build. This is one of those situations that's a bit unfortunate because it really doesn't live up to the rendering. I mean, that sort of three-dimensional quality, the sort of porous quality has been flattened quite dramatically. It looks much more conventional in a way. I mean, if our expectations weren't one image, you know, what we've been given might not be so disappointing.
Alan Brake, executive editor of the Architects newspaper in New York. Thanks very much for joining us on Section D. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, from New York to the other side of America, to Portland, Oregon. Postmodernism is undoubtedly one of the most reviled and most misunderstood styles of architecture from the post-war period. Identified by classical elements such as pediments, arches, symmetry and columns, all wrapped up in contemporary materials and very usually on a gargantuan scale, it's perhaps easy to see why. Postmodernist architecture spread through our cities in the 1990s and has had a hard time capturing the world's imagination ever since, which is why so many postmodern masterpieces are now under threat. One of the best examples of the style is the Portland Building, designed in 1982 by Michael Graves, perhaps the greatest postmodernist architect. Mocked, disliked, and very nearly demolished, it was announced late last year that it would be saved from the wrecking ball and $95 million invested in its restoration. To discuss the unpopularity of postmodernism, I'm joined by our Portland correspondent, Zach Dundas. Zach, if you could first of all start by describing the Portland Building to us.
The Portland Building is a major government office building, which is situated at the heart of downtown Portland. It is, roughly speaking, within an unofficial campus of government buildings. There are federal installations nearby. The city hall is right next door. And it was constructed as such to be sort of the centerpiece of that government center, if you will, in the middle of the city. It is a big cube that looks to some like a freshly wrapped Christmas present. It has the neoclassical elements that one would expect in a postmodern building. It has a sort of very 1980s color scheme of a sort of aqua blue, a beige, and a rusty red accent. And it is certainly one of the best known and undoubtedly the most controversial building in the city of Portland.
And it's now been there for over 30 years. I mean, has it always been a white elephant?
It has always been a subject of a great deal of controversy. I mean, sort of controversy mingled with a certain pride, because it is historically quite significant. It is the first significant work of postmodernism built in the United States by some reckonings, and it was an extraordinarily unusual building at the time of its construction. But it has always been bedeviled by controversy and, indeed, quite a few technical problems. It was built quite cheaply. In fact, much more cheaply than the average government building is constructed. And as a result, has had all manner of mechanical problems from the very beginning, and is considered by the people who work there sort of legendarily horrible place to be during the day.
So let's talk about the sort of the threat of it being demolished. I mean, how real was that, do you think?
Well, I don't know that there was a keen desire to smash the thing down or any sort of vindictive desire to destroy it, but as I said, it's been troubled from the beginning. It requires a tremendously expensive menu of repairs to get its technical systems up to modern specifications. There are certain problems with the design itself that have caused long-term issues with the building. For example, entrances are very poorly configured. There is an underground parking garage beneath it that has a very unfortunately situated entrance that essentially destroys the approach to the building from the most logical way that one would come toward it. And so there are lots of issues, and I think that what was under discussion earlier last year was what to do about it. I mean, this is a building that has caused a lot of grief for the government entities that are responsible for it. It also has its historic value. So rather than, I think that there were certainly some who said that it needs to be done away with because it's too expensive to fix. But I think that what was really being discussed was the dilemma of what to do about this troubled building that has this significant status.
Do you think in a case like this, I mean, obviously as an outsider looking in, you know, it's a great icon of postmodernism architecture, it's great to keep it, but actually in the context of Portland, does it fit in with the rest of the city?
Not particularly. I mean, Portland is, ironically, perhaps given this discussion, quite fanatical about historical preservation. And we have, for a West Coast U.S. city, in other words, a fairly new city, we have quite a stock of historic buildings, particularly a number of significant and a larger number of just simply lovely pre-war buildings. The Portland Building doesn't really fit with that style or heritage at all. I mean, it sits right next to and rather dwarfs and lords over our very small neoclassical City Hall, which is a building that people love. And the two right next to each other sort of show a sort of Jekyll and Hyde character, and they don't fit together at all.
Do you think this will sort of give a reason for the people of Portland to be proud now that it's sort of been recognized as a masterpiece?
You know, it's always had that element to its reputation. I mean, from the very beginning, people were excited about the fact that we were publicly funding a significant piece of architecture, and it came out of a very rigorous and elaborate competition and years of political process to build the thing. It's not that people have disliked that aspect of the building. That has always been a sort of mark of local pride, that we were among the first to sort of adopt and fund a major piece of postmodernism. The controversy has really stemmed from the fact that it was a poorly built building. It has been poorly maintained over the years as well, and so has become sort of over its lifespan a more and more problematic beast, if you will.
I want to talk to you about sort of the larger topic. I mean, it's a big subject here in London, where, you know, most of the, you know, the financial district of London was built in the 1980s to accommodate investment banks or whatever. And it is, you know, there's a great wealth of some good and some bad postmodernist buildings. But a lot of them are being knocked down to make way for, you know, Shards and Gherkins and all sorts of those kind of things. What's the general take on postmodernism in the US? They still not come around to it?
It's a somewhat vexed topic. You know, the current generation of architects, I don't think, has really ever embraced it. In fact, some would say have probably spent their careers reacting against it to a certain degree, depending on where they fall in a sort of generational calendar. The public has certainly never really embraced it. You can sort of see this divide in the United States between modernism, which is beloved by architects and design professionals, perhaps to an almost fetishistic degree at times, and the general public, who are generally enamored of sort of historicist or neo-retro pastiche. If you drive through any major American suburb, you'll see one sort of mock Tudor after another, one neo-Victorian after another. That's sort of where the popular heart lies. Meanwhile, it sometimes seems that every architect wants to design a modernist masterpiece straight out of the 1930s and 40s. So postmodernism has never really had a particularly strong constituency, either with design professionals or architects or the general public.
Well, good news for the Portland building and good news for postmodernism. Zach Dundas, our Portland correspondent, thanks very much for joining us.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said it's ridiculous that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Never uncontentious, thanks to a global recession, a focus on sustainability, and more young designers entering the profession than ever. The business of architecture around the world was under the microscope more than ever in 2014. As part of our special Globalist Design Look-Ahead show that aired last week, we heard from architecture critic, broadcaster and historian Tom Dykoff, who helped us look at what trends, projects and architectural practices might be making the front pages over the course of 2015. I caught up with Tom earlier. Tom, let's start, I think, in Helsinki with the Guggenheim, which was the shortlist was announced recently. And next year, we'll find out who and what will be built there on the waterfront for the Guggenheim.
Yeah, a fascinating competition. Again, it sort of attracted a lot of controversy as well as positive attention. A lot of locals saying they didn't really want to have a Guggenheim. And the Guggenheim, of course, has become the world's kind of totem for iconic architecture. And it's quite interesting to see the designs that have been published. They're all anonymous, but the published designs, which are all pretty muted, actually.
Yes.
They're certainly not these kind of big, spectacular things that we've come to expect from the Guggenheim. I think British Hopes are riding high with Azif Khan, who's one of the shortlisted architects, and I think one of the most interesting architects around at the moment. Not so much because he's not so interested in form making as in creating responsive environments or architecture that in some way reacts to the people around and within it, which I think is one of those kind
which
of growing
trends.
Exactly. It's one of these growing trends. I mean, it's been around really interest in it since the 1960s, but now we've finally got the technology to be able to create buildings, you know, covered with pixels or embedded with technology and wires and all sorts of technical things that I can't possibly understand, so that the building becomes almost like a chameleon, that we are able to almost play it and it responds to us, which is quite fascinating.
Yeah. And do you think the chances for us, I mean, all the submissions were anonymous, but I think it's quite obvious.
Yes,
what are the chances of that winning, do you think?
You know, he's certainly a rising star.
Yeah.
I think it would be very wise to pick him. If they wanted to have a kind of building that is a showstopper. On the other hand, they might want to respond to the context there. Finland, Helsinki, it's not renowned for showy buildings. You know, it's not renowned for kind of flamboyance. You know, whether they go for a much more Nordic, Scandinavian style project, of which there are many on the shortlist, might be more likely, I should have thought. It'd be a shame, really, because I think Azif does some rather fascinating projects. I mean, his project at the Sochi Winter Olympics last year, the so-called selfie building, where the exterior of the building responded and formed the faces of the photographs of the people who were around the building, was fascinating. I mean, you might say it's a one-liner, but the technology behind it and the intentions behind it to create a kind of architecture which we can all love and can become part of us was quite fascinating. I think it had lots of kind of hinterland and interest about it, I think.
Now let's talk about robots and 3D printing, which you're noticing might affect the built environment, maybe not the year ahead, but certainly a decade ahead.
I mean, actually, the most interesting things to me within architecture are not that someone's going to design this amazing new design or amazing form. I think we're kind of in the dog days of that, parametricism and computer-aided design, and on the one hand, and this kind of interest in lovely, touchy-feely, kind of beautiful textured kind of architecture. There's nothing really new happening, I think, within the aesthetics of architecture. What's interesting is that there is massive technological change, not only through computer generation of architecture, but also in the physical construction of building. We're seeing an awful lot of experimentation going on over the last 2 or 3 years about robotic builders, replacing the builders of architecture with robots. At MIT, I've done a lot of work on that. And we're seeing, interestingly, in 2014, Skanska, the big construction company, teamed up with Norman Foster to invest essentially in 3D, not 3D printing, but they're almost like the printing of concrete. It's almost like I can compare it to is sort of like squeezing stuff out of a toothpaste, and to try and revolutionize the building industry. It's long been the architect's frustration that essentially they might create futuristic buildings, but the building industry, the way we create buildings, is pretty medieval still. It's still, you know, mostly blokes in a muddy field putting one brick on top of another. And I think now, driven, incidentally, mostly by the Far East, who want to build buildings quicker and quicker and quicker, and of course that's where the money is, there's finally money going into what might be a revolutionary change in the construction of buildings.
Wow. Like corn on the cob, which
Yes, yeah.
on the flip side, another thing you've noticed recently.
Yeah, an extraordinary project in New York at PS1. Every year they have this extraordinary pavilion, a bit like the Serpentine Pavilion in London. And in 2014, they created a rather amazing one made out of corn on the cob stalks and fungi and mushrooms and so on. There's been a lot of interest within product design world, certainly among younger generation, about creating objects out of organic material. And we're beginning to see a crossover now within architecture. So it's organic architecture. By that, I don't mean curvy shapes. I mean literally organic architecture. And it taps into a lot of interest in sustainability, in the reuse of materials. Mm. It connects also with the that connection between high technology and biomimicry as well, about how we can learn from nature, how we can absorb that in the way we construct buildings. So it kind of taps in very much with this kind of younger generation who are very interested in the ethics of architecture. Mm. It's, you know, what better kind of architecture could you get than one that kind of grows literally in front of your eyes?
That was architecture critic Tom Dykhoff there, speaking to me as part of a special design look ahead, which aired last week on The Globalist. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We've heard the latest architecture news from New York today already, and now it's time to head to Tokyo and speak to our bureau chief Fiona Wilson there. A little earlier, our very own David Pleasant spoke to Fiona and reviewed some of the best exhibitions from the worlds of architecture and design in the Japanese capital. To start, Fiona and David discussed the appetizingly rich design culture of the humble ramen dish.
There's an exhibition at the moment in Matsuya in Ginza. They have a really fantastic little design gallery there. It's where the Japan Design Committee you know, has a sort of a home in a way. It has a shop and a gallery, and they always have a really interesting selection of exhibitions. And the one at the moment is about ramen bowls, and they're all made in Mino, which is in the middle of Japan, in Gifu. They've been making ramen bowls there for I don't know how long. They've been making ceramics since the Middle Ages there. And what they've done is they've got a group of very interesting people just to decorate these bowls in different ways, you know, just in a way to talk about the means of production. And it's not really about the ramen, it's more about the ceramics industry and in Mino, which is a really interesting place. And they've got all sorts of people like Junya Ishigami, very popular young architect, Tadanori Yoko, the graphic artist. So it's quite an interesting mix of people.
And this is obviously a design exhibition, but if we can linger on the ramen a little bit, I know you want to steer away from it, but do you think has that kind of ramen tradition, and this is perhaps something that we should be discussing on the menu rather than Section D, but has that kind of boomeranged back as it's become more and more popular elsewhere in the world? Have the Japanese kind of reassessed how important the ramen and the whole culture of it is in Japan?
Well, I mean, you know, ramen has never gone out of fashion in Japan. I think what has happened is people have become much more aware of the value of these sort of, in a way, low-class foods. Ramen is everywhere. It's at every station. And what's interesting about ramen is every region has a different version of it. And I think people have become much more aware of the regional differences. And it's sort of become quite cool to know the difference, you know, the difference between Fukuoka ramen, Hakata ramen and Sapporo ramen. And people are very particular about the ramen they like and don't like. So yeah, the people are quite, they're connoisseurs of ramen. So it's not like it's super fashionable, but it's, you know, food that people eat every day. And yes, they're very particular about it, I would say.
And before we get too hungry, let's steer back to topic and let's talk about design again. And an exhibition of an architect, a famous architect in Tokyo.
Yes, well, Kiyonori Kikutake, it takes a few goes to say that name. He really was one of the big figures of post-war Japanese architecture. He was a metabolist. Everyone need to Google what that is. But I mean, they put up some pretty extraordinary buildings. There was a whole group in the post-war years. Kikutake was one of the leaders. I don't know if people would know the Edo Tokyo Museum, the big museum about Tokyo in Tokyo. That's an extraordinary building. And his own house was absolutely wonderful, called Sky House. That's still standing, actually, although he died in 2011 when he was 83. And I think he's one of these architects whose career is being reassessed now. I think, you know, in some ways he was overshadowed by Kisho Kurokawa, who's another metabolist who's, you know, people know very well. He did the Capsule Tower. But Kikutake was right up there with him. And also just the location of the exhibition's very interesting. It's a newish, it's just over a year now, the National Archives for Modern Architecture. And Japan has decided to put together all its post-war architectural archives and put them in a new home. So it's a great chance to go and look at the new building. It's actually an old building, but it's a renovated building.
And now we go to inside one of Kikutake's buildings that you mentioned, the Edo Tokyo Architecture Museum. That's the same museum that you mentioned, is it?
Well, interestingly, that very museum, the Kikutake, is the one in central Tokyo. That building is in central Tokyo, but the same museum has an annex on the edge of Tokyo, which is where this exhibition I'm interested in is about. But I mean, this, for so many reasons, is worth going to. It's the open-air part of the Edo Tokyo Museum, and it preserves all sorts of amazing buildings from Tokyo. I think Tokyo's been beaten about over the years by firebombing, earthquakes, all sorts of disasters, and it's great to see these old buildings looked after. Of course, we'd rather see them on the streets of Tokyo, but it just wasn't to be. And you see them in this collection, in this park, and they're absolutely wonderful. You know, all sorts of random domestic buildings, dentists, shops, houses. There are some really fantastic buildings. Kunio Maekawa, really fantastic post-war Japanese architect. His house is in this open-air museum, preserved perfectly. But actually, the exhibition that brought me to talk about this wonderful museum is not really related to that. It's quite an unusual exhibition, actually. It's about Studio Ghibli, which is, I'm sure many people would know, it's the studio that has made these amazing Hayao Miyazaki animated films like Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki, Howl's Moving Castles. These are really, really big, successful animation films in Japan. In fact, I was interested to see that Spirited Away is still the top grossing film in Japan ever. Still not overtaken by Frozen, I'm glad to report. And what this exhibition does is it looks at the amazing architecture that is imagined in these films, and it turns them into 3D. They've made models of the architecture. And if you know these films, they're so rich in detail. They're brilliantly imagined, these films. I mean, really, anyone should see them of any age. And they evoke, it's a sort of fantasy Japan, but at the same time, it's a very real, very recognizable Japan. And Japanese people absolutely love these films generally. You know, it allows them the chance to see the buildings that appear in these animated films in three dimensions, which is it's such an interesting idea.
Amazing sounding exhibition there, very evocative. And finally, we look at the ties between Japan and a European, Central European alpine nation. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, this is an interesting one. I feel like Japan goes through phases. You know, it's been through a Danish phase, always in a Danish phase. Denmark's still super popular. Norway's had its moment quite recently. And now it's Switzerland's turn. It had quite a big year in 2014. It was the 150th anniversary of Japanese-Swiss diplomatic relations. Doesn't sound very exciting, but that was in itself an excuse to have a whole series of exhibitions and events. And there is about to be, from the 17th of January, a huge exhibition at Tokyo Opera City, big gallery in the middle of Tokyo, a big exhibition about Swiss design. And it's a real run-through of, you know, a comprehensive guide to Swiss design. And I think a few people in Japan might be surprised at how much Swiss design they already know, in fact. I don't think many people even realize that Le Corbusier was Swiss, in fact. Hate to say that, but I think many people assume he was French. It goes through everything from Swiss Army knives to Le Corbusier, Swatch watches. It runs the gamut of product, design, architecture.
Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson there, talking us through some of the design shows that are not to be missed in Tokyo at the moment. Still to come today, we meet Portugal's biggest interior designer in Madeira, and we see what headlines will be making the news in the world of fashion over the course of the rest of this year. This is Monocle 24, and you're listening to Section D. Pebbles, Sea and Sun. This is how interior designer Nini Andrade Silva describes both her work and her hometown on the island of Madeira. The Portuguese designer is best known for her minimalist approach, ensuring that each space fits perfectly, both aesthetically and with the people who use it. Monocle's Carlota Ribello met with Nini in Madeira in one of her most awarded hotels, The Vine. They started by chatting about how pebbles and cobblestones are an intrinsic part of her style as a designer.
The Vine for me is very special. First, because it was the whole story about Madeira. If you come to the Vine, you will find a little Madeira inside this hotel. I think that's why we receive so many awards around the world. Even today, we're still the best design hotel in the world. It's quite nice to have that, at least the award. And the thing it is, the pebbles is because you call a different name. You say,
pebbles, cobblestones. You can call it various different names.
Yes, I always call pebbles because I'm the girl of the pebbles. And that's when I was long, many, many years ago in Madeira, we had the little boys who used to go on the beach. And the big boats come to South Africa and they all stop in Madeira. And they used to go with the parents to sell things on the boats and to beg for some things. And we used to call these boys the boys of the pebbles. That's in Portuguese, it's Garotos do Calhau. That's why, since I was a kid, I always said to my mother, I want to help these people. I want to do something for them. That's why I have a foundation called The Girl of the Pebble. And everything in my life goes around the pebbles. I have the paintings, furniture, even the interior design of this hotel is everything around the pebbles. And now I'm opening my museum here in Madeira, in the Arbo, in a little island you have on the Arbo of Funchal. And it will be the name of The Girl of the Pebbles. And it's where everything starts.
In terms of your let's say, artistic expression and your style as a designer. Is Madeira very present in your style?
No, it's like this. Madeira is just present in my life because it's Madeira giving my energy and that's the place where I belong. I have a style, but depends where I am. I do the thing of that place. Like if I'm in Colombia, like I did an hotel in Colombia, was everything with the gold and the emeralds. If it was in another country, now we're doing one in Timor-Leste, and it's the sandal. The sandal is the wood they have in the Timor-Leste. We always do the things in agreement to the place where you are. But this style, like a soul, it's always from Madeira for sure.
You go to a lot of TED Talks and TED Conferences, and in one of them that I was watching, someone described your style as minimalism, from your name, Nini. What is minimalism?
Yeah, the people say, I'm not minimalist, I'm minimalist. People believe I do things with soul. And I believe it's quite true, because when you go to a place, it's not really what you see, it's what you feel. And if you feel something, when I do something, you have to feel when you see. And that's what people call minimalism. It's a minimalism with soul.
How would you describe it? What is it?
You know, it's not, like I said, it's not what you see. It's really what you feel. You have to feel wow when you go to a place I did. And if you don't feel wow, means I didn't do right. It's not minimalist. But normally people will always do wow. It's funny. I did an hotel in Lisbon called Fontana Park. That hotel have 10 years. And even today I see people taking pictures. It's quite nice when I arrive to a place and I see people after 10 years still take pictures, like if it is new. And I think that is really what is important. It's a thing you stay forever.
We've been talking a lot about hotels and your projects in hotels, but you not only do that, you also do private projects and even office spaces. Can you tell me a bit about your most recent ones or the ones you would like to highlight?
Yeah, it's like this. Private houses, we do very, very nice ones around the world, but normally we're not allowed to talk about the clients because it's private. But we do furniture and many other things. And the furniture is very important for me because I have a collection called The Girl of the Pebbles, and we did exhibitions, many in the Maison Objet in Italy, in Abu Dhabi, and around the world, in China, Shanghai. And now the people in China, they really want me to design more pieces of that collection for them. And it's quite nice. And I did one nice thing. It was with the chair I did with Cristiano Ronaldo for the Art of Chairs. And it was, you have to have a international person, well-known, a celebrity, and a designer who can be together and make something. And what I did, it was a chair for Christian. It was like a wave, because it was very nice. Christian belongs to the same island like me, from Madeira, and I knew it, his story, and I know he came from a big wave would take him to the world. And I make like a chaise longue in a way of a wave, a gold wave, and it's like Cristiano growing and be the star is in our days. And it's quite funny because this chair goes around the world in exhibitions. And now in China, we had an exhibition and we had to put policemen around the chair because everybody wants to sit on the chair. It was quite nice. Yeah, and this chair will be in Madeira in the museum at the Arbo too.
Talking about Cristiano Ronaldo, that makes me think about your most recent partnership. You've now paired up and opened offices all around the world, you were telling me before. So how did you evolve from being a single designer to the stage you are today?
After we start to receive awards and receiving lots of things around the world, the people, we start to have more international work and getting bigger and bigger. And I thought it's quite difficult to be alone because you have to know people know about the law, about how to deal with the other countries and all of that. And I was doing this hotel in Cabo Verde with Miguel Saraiva, the architect who is my partner now. And we said, one day we have to be together and work. And when this thing start to grow, I found Miguel and I said, Miguel, what do you think about we talk together? And he said, yes, let's talk. And then we talk together and we get together. Now I belong to Saraiva and Associados. And we have 9 ateliers around the world. It's quite nice.
Which locations?
Okay, we have in Brazil, Venezuela, Colombia, Kazakhstan, Algeria, Lisbon, Funchal, Beijing, Shanghai, Singapore. And we're going to open 2 more, but it's still secret.
So 2015 is going to be an interesting year for you?
Yes, all the years is interesting for me if I'm alive. I said I will only stop when I die.
That was Monocle's Carlota Rebello speaking to Portuguese interior designer Nini Andrade Silva in Madeira.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our 4 daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Hello and welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Last week on Monocle 24, the Globalist Show aired a very special 2015 design look ahead, part of which was devoted to the world of fashion. Following on from the big reshuffle at fashion's top table that took place over the course of last year, an empty space at Gucci, as well as John Galliano's return to the industry, the next 12 months should prove to be very interesting. To conjecture on the news stories which will have us talking next year, I spoke to FT men's fashion critic Charlie Porter. Charlie, let's start where we should in January with Galliano, who's coming back to Margiela.
Yeah.
Are you excited?
It's really interesting because we heard rumours that there was going to be a show in London of women's wear doing men's wear, and that got my house. So I was like, no, what are they doing? They're taking over LCM. And then we found out it was Galliano, and it's like, okay, that's the most amazing thing ever. It's going to be a really small show. It's like 100 people, and most of them are not press. I think it's mostly friends. They're taking his return very seriously in a kind of real sort of like his stability and his emotional state way. You know, I think it's the right way to do it, to not pretend that he's not fragile, you know, and I think he's very open about that himself. And so it feels really right to do it in London as a small show. So basically it's the Artisanal Collection, which is the Margiela Couture line. I think it's called Artisanal Statue. I'm not sure, but anyway, it's the Margiela Couture collection, which should really be shown a couple of weeks later in Paris after menswear, but they're showing it in London.
How do you think he fits the DNA of Margiela? What do you think is a good
fit?
Well,
I mean, they're contemporaries, aren't they? I mean, like Margiela, they both came through in the early 80s, so they are from the same time. So I think there's a similar sensibility. I think Margiela, people assume, is this very sort of like kind of removed and a bit po-faced brand, whereas actually it's hilarious. And like if you go back to what he did, it was really shocking. And there's such parity with what Galliano does.
Let's move to Italy now, to Gucci, where late last year the news has revealed that Frida Giannini will be leaving next year.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Because, I mean, the figures don't lie and they haven't been good for a while.
Mm. What's the future for Gucci, do you think? I mean, obviously, since Tom Ford heyday, Frida had a good couple of years, but...
I mean, the thing is, you've got to look back even before Tom and what Tom did to Gucci. And Tom cleaned Gucci up from the 80s world of branding, where we licensed out and, like, there'd be cigarette packets and whatever, umbrellas, any old toot with Gucci on or Saint Laurent. That's what that whole thing was about in the 90s, getting rid of that and making it specific. It was really interesting when Tom left, Gucci tried to pretend that Tom didn't exist. And like there's a Gucci museum in Florence and like he's barely mentioned. Brands love to do like weird anniversaries and they made the big hoo-ha about their 95th or something because they could wait 5 more years. And Tom, like, it was like this thing that had made Gucci relevant didn't happen. And I think that's a shame. And the thing that Frida did, and I like Frida a lot, and she did do a good job at certain things. What she did was she kind of connected back with a lot of things that Tom got rid of. In the end, it's kind of left Gucci a bit sort of like wishy-washy. There's not a strict style or strict idea.
Mm.
And it's also not gleeful either. It's a real shame. I remember when the stores were still like fake sort of like horse things. I remember going by my first Gucci G-belt thing on red, and it was so exciting. It was such a thrill. Like mid-90s. And I don't think anyone would feel that going to a Gucci store now. And that's really killer.
What do you think they'll do now? Will they try and coach really young talent to try and reinvent, or
I hope that they are learning the lesson of Saint Laurent, which is Kering Group, and obviously it's way smaller. I think none of us really comprehend how big Gucci is. Like it makes up so much of their profit, and Saint Laurent is tiny. So to change all the stores in Saint Laurent, it's easier. But what Saint Laurent have done is completely made one complete unified message that is completely obsessive, and you go in those stores and people are just buying like crazy.
Mm.
And I think they need to like do everything. They need to change everything. They need to change the stores. They need to change the attitude. What they need is some hero products as well. It's what they're really lacking. This sounds like I'm being really damning, but like, I don't know anyone that would be like, oh, hey, I'm going to go to Gucci to buy some trousers, or, oh my God, their blazers are amazing. Like, and you want, in the end, people to be like, oh God, I really want that.
Mm.
They've got it with the loafer. You know, they've got certain items like that. But I think they really need to do really basic, boring stuff.
Yeah.
Which makes stuff that people go crazy about.
Mm.
That's what it's about in the end, isn't it? I mean,
so let's look forward. Any trends that we should be keeping our eyes peeled for?
My obsession at the moment is technical outerwear or technical clothing.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote about it in the FT a couple of weeks ago about how it's so crazy this time of year, like the shows that we saw for Autumn Winter like 12 million years ago, however long we saw them, the outerwear was like these double-faced vicuna coats and like drop shoulder raglan sleeve like things. And like when you get to December, you don't want to wear that. You want to wear like a zip up, super padded, super functional, something that's made for like the slopes, but actually you wear in a city. And I'm fascinated by the disconnect in menswear and womenswear too, but like in menswear particularly, this sort of what men really wear and what they show us. And I think sport is becoming such an important kind of product category. And I think it's going to become more and more. I mean, it has been like for all our lives, even though we pretend it hasn't, like with trainer culture and everything. But I think now it's so much part of what men wear. And I think that fashion needs to realize that and actually start using technical fabrics and technical expertise in their fashion. So it's not just, oh, that looks pretty. It's like, oh, that's pretty, and it's functional.
Yeah.
So I'm desperate for that to be at the Autumn Winter shows, which start like on January the whatever. And by the end of January, if it's not that, I'll be very sad.
We shall see. Charlie Porter, Financial Times men's fashion critic. Thanks very much for joining us. And to end the show, let's turn to the pages of Monocle Magazine's annual foray into all things Alpine, our Alpino newspaper. In the design section, we ventured into the mountain valleys north of Switzerland's sedate capital of Bern. At Baalstahl, one architect has reimagined the nature and use of one very typical agricultural building type, the Stöckli. This is traditionally the house for the retired farmer and is a feature of countless Swiss farmsteads. Internationally acclaimed architect and local boy Pascal Flammer decided to design and build the Stöckli and then move into it with his young family. David Pleasant spoke to him about the end result, a building that looks to the local landscape as well as Japan and Brazil for inspiration.
Basically, there was an existing Stöckli, and this existing Stöckli was rotten. I mean, it had to be replaced. And that's where I came in, and the building commissioner asked me to do the new Stöckli. Principally, what I was trying to do is, since this Stöckli is in a very wonderful landscape, but there is not much more than the landscape, so principally the landscape is the topic of the Stöckli. And what I did, actually, I produced three very different floors, and each of these floors has a very different relation to the landscape. In ground floor, it's this very horizontal floor. It's only 2 meters and 30 high. It's fully glazed, and one is slightly sunk into the ground, so of around 75 centimeters. So one is in a very physical connection to the outside. The upper floor is a very different relation. There we have very high spaces. They're up to 6 meters high. And the relation to the outside is the one via a large window. So as a consequence, you look at the outside like as you do looking at the picture or so. Huh? It's a vis-a-vis condition of a controlled condition. The third relation is the one below ground. It's a space that has only a zenithal light. And therefore, you are in Baalstahl, you are in this Stöckli, but it is your brain, basically, that sets where you are. You could basically also be in Los Angeles or in Bayreuth or so. So the third condition is kind of the non-relational relation to the surroundings. So I would say, basically, this building is about perception of landscape.
And also the Stöckli itself is something that references the local situation and Switzerland. But you've got some outside references and influences, would you say? You've looked to Japan and Brazil, perhaps, for some of the inspiration as well. Maybe talk us through that.
Basically, it is a very traditional Swiss timber construction, which, if you look at the constructive means, you quite quickly have these gabled roofs. Huh? So we are, let's say, not really in close to Switzerland, but we are close to timber, you know, just the way how timber works. And of course, Switzerland has a good timber culture, but also Japan. So Japanese architecture and Japanese construction was always, let's say, a very important field to look at, because the way they do things is very nicely done and very inspiring. Same is somehow for Brazil. I mean, this building has also a lot to do with Brazil, even though, let's say, most of the Brazilian architecture comes out of concrete structures and not timber. Funny enough, this building is actually, in reality, it's kind of a concrete system. Huh? The structural system comes out of building bridges. But it has then been applied to timber construction. It is timber, yes, but it is thought, as we do think, concrete bridges.
Pascal, we should mention that you've decided to live in this Stöckli, and we can hear the sounds of family life in the background there. Tell us a little bit about that and how that will work with the true function of the Stöckli. Presumably, you'll have to move out eventually.
Yeah, actually, the thing is like this. The farmer at the very moment is still in his main house. So I think I have another 10 years that I could stay here in case I want to stay here. I think we will stay here maybe another 5 years or 10 years before the farmer moves in. And for the moment, we enjoy this situation here very much. We have two little kids and my wife is from Paris. So we live in a very different situation at the moment, but mainly also have the impression that differences make you happy or make you feel that you're actually living. At the moment, this is a brand new situation for us, and we're very happy to be out here in the woods.
That was David Pleasant speaking to Swiss architect Pascal Flammer about his newly designed Stöckli. Find out more in this year's edition of Alpino newspaper, out now. And that's all we have time for in today's Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show, or if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out, in tribute to the monument that is the Portland building that we heard about at the beginning of the show, we have what many might consider as the quintessentially postmodern New Order with Bizarre Love Triangle. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye. Every time I think of you, I'm